Hey everybody, welcome to today's episode of No Killing Goblins. We're here to talk about Flos. God damn it, Dragoness. I don't know how to introduce you anymore. I'm Oshi. this is some dude.
Yep, this is just some dude named Dragoness who's actually here to talk about Flos. Oshi will be here today to talk about literally anything that he possibly can that isn't Floss.
I've been having to re-record this. Clearly, I'm dedicated. I'm dedicated, I'm here.
Yeah, no, I don't doubt your dedication, just your ability to talk about Floss without getting weird about it, man.
I do not get weird about it. I just have one opinion, and nothing has changed it in 13 million words.
Alright, it's not so much that you have that opinion, having an opinion, all fine and good. It's just, I don't know, man. It gets so...
Which is why I don't talk about it. Honestly, which is why I don't talk about it with you or anybody else, because I can hear it in my head. It's repetitive and not very helpful to the people who care and want nuance. And my thing has nuance, but it's one opinion. It's not always the thing. Okay, let's talk about brighter news, like the world. Oh, well, no, the world's horrible. People are burning to death. No, that can't do. Oh, wait. Gravesong's coming out.
Yeah. I am beyond excited to finally be able to, like, hear that story in Andy's voice with, like, the music and everything. It's going to be great.
For those who don't know, Gravesong is the first book in Pirates' side series, The Singer of Tarandria. It's coming out April 30th, 2024. Andrea Personeau is still the narrator for the series as well, and she sings. She, like, pirate incorporated music into the actual text, and apparently Andrea did full cover recordings of it, and it's all there, and they got all that's. This is why it took so long to come out, because they were trying to get song rights and all that. So happy day, I guess, in a month or two.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting. And yeah, for those who aren't super aware, this is Kara's story. It's our chance to see who, in a lot of ways, the more I look at this, quite possibly, like, the most important Earther who isn't Erin or Ryoka and what's going on in her life and her story.
I have a difference of opinion on levels of importance for different Earthers, but sure, she's very important. And I did enjoy, okay, I'm going to be honest, I've had people bombard me with the fact that they didn't really like Kara, but it's, again, it feels like pirate, okay. I've read the manuscript, you've read the manuscript, because we got to see the thing come out on Yonder. Here's what I'm going to say. Pirate continues their trend of writing unlikable protagonists and making everybody else more entertaining than the fucking protagonist. A little bit.
This is going to sound weird, because as much as I really hated Kara, I didn't mind reading about her. There was one scene in that whole book where I'm like, Jesus Christ, woman, this is agonizing. I feel like I am reading the deep cringe, and this is difficult to engage with. And that was, a certain speech.
We can't do too many spoilers. Anyway, but I know what you're talking about. That's exactly what it was for me.
But that was nothing like Ryoka, where I had that feeling like I was engaging with cringe that was difficult to fucking make my soul not retch up. Like, it felt like every chapter, right? This is a totally different experience.
I would agree. And the thing that I don't know how to describe it. Like, Kel, just does not like her. There's something about Kara that is either just, like, a repellent to her. And I was talking to her about it, and I just could not understand. I couldn't connect with her thing. And then the other, so I was like, it's just her thing. But I did read the book, and I enjoyed it as, like, a soft read. But I didn't. There is one thing I did not like about Kara. It wasn't her, the parts that I've like people complain about. It's because I don't feel like I ever scratch anything but the surface of Kara.
You see, that's one of the things I find most interesting about it. And honestly, I kind of felt that way too, because for people who are on the Patreon, some early drafts for the sequel of this, Huntsong and so on, have been released. And I love the fact that there is so much about Kara that even in her own internal monologue, she guards herself. She's careful, she's paranoid, she's very clearly like got something going on, and I find that tantalizing and interesting, although I understand how it can make it difficult to root for her as a protagonist.
It doesn't make it difficult to root for her as a protagonist. It makes it difficult for me. So what connects me to a character is there has to be something that connects me to the character. Sidebar on this, I'm watching and more a little bit more anime recently because turns out some of them are actually good, like Delicious in Dungeon, which I'm obsessed with, and a friend of mine recommended I go and try out the not Alchemist. What's the other thing? Apothecary.
Oh, yeah, The Apothecary Diaries.
Yeah, the Apothecary Diaries.
Okay.
And the first five episodes, I was having a little bit of a difficulty scratching past that surface. I wasn't connecting with her. What really pissed me off is we had like four episodes, and she never once, outside of the first episode, her father was just like completely forgotten. Like he didn't even exist. It wasn't until the fifth episode that she sent a letter to, like she mentioned that she sent a letter to him. Like it was so weird for me that someone could just like go through their entire life after and leave behind their fa like their father, their family, and not think about them for the as long as they. And that's the parallel I'm drawing to Kara here. It's just that here I wonder how much of it is a plot device, how much of it is Kara herself, and how much of it is a narrative tool from Pirate Abba, and those things all create this level of like I'm not quite sure where I stand with her.
Okay,
And now
yeah,
this,
I kind of get what you mean. Although I will say, much like the thing with Apothecary Diaries, some people are just like that, and some relationships are just like that. I don't want to spoil anything in Apothecary Diaries or in fucking Gravesong, but I'll just say I feel like there are a lot of character moments that are difficult for me to understand as something I would do, but that I feel like are coming from a place where it's going to make sense for this person.
Speaking of some things that are like isekais and animes and all that, so y'all know I love Ilona Andrews. I love me some Ilona. So Ilona Andrews is a pretty big like traditional publishing person, like writer. They regularly hit the New York Times bestseller list, the Amazon bestseller list, all that stuff, and they make lots of money and lots of people know who they are. And they came out that they're going to shop around and try to release some a story that they're titling Maggie the Undying, and it's an isekai. They don't even try to hide it. It is a full-on isekai. She like is obsessed with some kind of book series. Like they give out three chapters as like a spoiler thing, as a feeder thing, and it's a full-on isekai. It's this woman who was obsessed with this fantasy series, and she walks out one day and she ends up naked on the ground at on the sit in the fucking like in the story, so to speak. Like everything is happening exactly as the story happened, and the trick to all of this is Ilona Andrews is like Ilona and Gordon do not pull their punches. When they say a world is brutal, a world is brutal. When they say somebody is like terrible, the people are terrible. There is blood on the ground, there is guts in the. So it's very like this world is a brutal world, and you get to experience it from the very beginning. Because the first chapter, she gets stabbed and dies, but she comes back to life and she gets better.
Oh God, the ones where you can die and come back are always the worst.
Well,
But
no. Here's the thing. She doesn't come back her corpse gets thrown into the river and floats onto the area, and she comes. So no, like there's consequences to like everything. Never ever expect like things to go the same way. But
Listen,
sorry, I
just
didn't.
not being able to die is its own consequence when you can still be killed. But I honestly, I'm not surprised. Like, you know, the isekai is a long-standing classic genre with roots in both Eastern and Western literature, going all the way back to a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. I'm happy to see more traditional publishers giving it a shot, or traditional
But
rights.
I don't think they are, though, because they're the Alona Andrews is they wrote it themselves, and they're trying to find a partner to sell the series. And by the way, it plays on all of the tropes that you would expect from any kind of like portal fantasy where somebody like disappears from one world and appears in another. Like everything we would expect in our genre, it's there. And it's very genre savvy. It's literally based on the idea that of someone like one of us, obsessed with the Wandering Inn, ends up in the world of the Wandering Inn. Although we would never expect it, but it's more like someone ends up in a medieval world where the king is horrible and everybody carries a sword and occasionally slavery happens. Oh my God, it's just, I love it. I really do.
If you're like tooling around and picking up a few anime for this season, I feel like I really need to mention the fucking like anime of the fucking year right now, Shangri-La Frontier.
What? What? What are you talking about? I thought that was Frieren.
I love Frieren, but I think Shangri-La Frontier is better. It's not as deep. Like, don't get me wrong. It is not this existential fucking meditation on eternity and the connections that such an eternal, long-lived being will form and lose over its lifetime that Frieren is. But it is actually the single best, like, video game anime I have ever watched or read or done anything. Like, it gets it, Oshi. It is a story that genuinely comes from a place of loving video games and loving why people play video games and why video games can be so appealing and what the way that they can help you find friendships with random people in your life. And it's just a world you can fall into. I would play this game, Ushi, and it is so good. I really cannot strongly recommend it enough. And all of my other anime recommendations are for people as cracked and insane as I am, like Bravern or Sasaki and Peeps. And
I'm
fucking.
just gonna say this. This Shangri-La like didn't even cross my radar just because it looked like another attempt at like badly written like oh stuck in a VR world
Oh,
bullshit.
no, it's
Like
not stuck.
the no I'm not saying it's stuck. I mean like that's the like a badly written like anime. That's one of the things that I've begun to notice is that I was talking to someone about this earlier today. It's like anime had this boom period where it was sort of getting acquainted with the rest of the world, and more of the millennials got old enough that they like it became more mainstream, and they like overproduced on all the bullshit with no writing, shitty content all over the place to draw as many eyes as people. And now the cycle has like turned around, and now they no longer need to create as much bullshit, so they can be pickier with the scripts. So good scripts are and good like animes are being produced, like Vinland Saga and like Frieren and I'm sure maybe Shangri-La. I don't know.
Yeah, so the only thing I'll say is that's kind of true, except for the part where they haven't been making less. If anything, they make more anime every season than they did the last season. It's
That is
just they
true.
have hit a
That is true.
rhythm where it seems like for almost like I want to say this is going to be closing on 2 years of seasons where
2 years. That sounds about
everything
right.
is maybe more, but where everything is a banger and everything is just at the top of its game, and all the original content is great, and all the adaptations are good and good adaptations, as long as Netflix doesn't get involved. But even Netflix put out that fucking amazing Pluto adaptation. So.
Okay. I'm just gonna say it. You know how, like, anime in general, what repulses me for most anime is bad writing. And the fact that they can never finish anything, for fuck's sake. So, seeing things like Dungeon Meshi or Delicious in Dungeon on Netflix, it's a fully completed anime. It has good writing. It's based off fucking D&D, of all things. And they res like they the adaptation is being done by Trigger, and the art is so good.
You've
I
never
love
seen
it.
food porn until you've seen Trigger do food porn.
I had my
Oh,
moments. I
I need
had
to actually
moments.
really like throw up a fucking flag here for a moment, everybody.
What?
Dungeon Meshi, sorry, Delicious in Dungeon is not normal food porn. If you're the type of person who gets squeamish at the idea of actually dispatching and butchering an animal and that kind of stuff, this is not for you. This is a story about butchering animals and monsters that you find in dungeons to have a self-sustaining fucking push to reach the bottom when you can't afford your own rations. And for
That's part of it.
well, I'm not getting into the plot. I'm just getting into like the if somebody hears this as food porn and they go in expecting, traditional anime food porn, and the next thing they know, a giant scorpion or a cockatrice is getting butchered. And I know some people get squeamish about that, and I figure I'll throw that one up way ahead of
Okay.
time.
That's fair. But the point I'm trying to make is that there is more variety when it comes to both the scripting and the art that's being produced in anime. And I'm super impressed by what's been happening because every season I tend to have at least one anime I can actually watch, and that has not been true for a very long time. Over a decade, I would say, where I would like maybe watch an anime every year, once a year. And now like follow a series once a year, but like now it's once every season, and I genuinely find myself entertained. Not something that's common for
Yeah,
me.
and I think
And
you came in
like,
late because honestly, there have been there have been a lot of anime worth checking out. But I think there's a lot of people like you who were into anime when we were younger millennials, and anime was like the new cool thing that was different from what we had over here, and then kind of dropped off, and it's just been here getting better and hitting harder, and I don't know, how do you feel about giant robots, Oshi? Because I have an amount of incredibly hot, shirtless, gay military guys with robots, if you're interested in another
I
show.
am not doing a Gundam run again.
No, it's not Gundam. This is not Gundam.
First up, I resent the implication that I'm like a Johnny come lately who went in and out. I loved anime when I was 12 years old, and I was the weirdo who was not obsessed with Pokemon, but who loved Cardcaptor Sakura, and came home and watched the American adaptation. If I was a woman, it would have been acceptable for me to get the posters and dress up as fucking Sakura, or do like want to be the one of those creepy girls who like fully got into how much Clamp loved the fact that every guy was gay and only like one guy was allowed to be straight and be in love with the main character.
I mean, we could talk
Anyway.
about Clamp romance never.
Yeah. But the fact that I know all this should tell you just
No,
how
I
deep
wasn't
my
saying you were
fucking
a
love
Johnny
goes.
come lately. I'm just saying that there's a lot of people like that who were real deep into it and who sometime in like their 20s kind of dropped off and didn't start or keep following it as deeply. And I think that there's a lot of like the news has kind of really spread at this point that anime has just it anime keeps hitting out bangers. It is just one after another every season, and I'm exhausted just trying to keep track of it all.
I'm fine with like the level of content that's being released. I think at some point they'll hit like peak anime. It's like PTV. Eventually it'll hit the peak of that point. right now the reason the content is expanding is because they finally figured out, oh, these people who live outside of Japan, they have money and they do want to spend money and they are watching this stuff and, oh, we can make money. And anyway, I'm happy, but we're moving on.
Yeah, like a lot of Western money has been making stuff just happen.
Did you see that Funimation has been shut down?
Yeah, it's sad, but it was inevitable.
It was inevitable. Like, but that does that's like the sign of like consolidation. Anyway, yeah, stuff's happening, and the reason Maggie the Undying got put on our radar by our wonderful. Is she a manager now, or is she our editor? What do we call Kyler? Producer, excuse me. By our wonderful producer is because in the bigger scheme of things, it's a sign. It's one of the signs that I look at. Like, I've been watching the publishing space for a long time, and I think I don't know if it's inching closer, but we're certainly getting to a point where, like, lit RPGs and isekai and the kind of stuff that's coming out of anime is going to start hitting the traditional publishing sphere and certainly hitting books, because fantasy is being heavily influenced by, like, the trends that came out of anime, because I hate saying these words, but millennials are now old enough to be the creator class, right? Or the 30 and the late 20s, 30-year-olds, or even early 40-year-olds who are now running things or are producing the content, right?
Yeah. And I think that it's also circular. There is, like, really specifically with Japan, although it's not unique to them, this situation where so much of modern fantasy in Japan and isekai is really heavily influenced by our, like, 90s fantasy and earlier, and D&D, especially D&D, right? And you can look at, and now it's come back over and it's our turn, although isekai has been here for a long fucking time and is not as unique as people, I think it is, but definitely the tropes and take on it that they have are. And now it's our turn, just like it's gone back and forth with us since fucking cowboys and samurai.
That, I mean, let's be real, the Western myth, the myth of the West, of the American West, is probably one of the foundational myths of the United States. It's literally what, I don't even know, it's one of the only non-exports, right? Everything else is something that the U.S. has absorbed from elsewhere, but the American West, that's just the United States
of
stuff.
Kind of, except for the part where the back and forth between fucking American Western movies and American samurai movies, I'm certain somebody who's a real expert on this could tell you the origin points of both and who started what, when, where, and how they influenced.
Well, I was thinking more of, like, the cultural significance of the American West and how it was defined and how it was represented, and not necessarily the filmography or the kind of mediums or structures or anything like that.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking about it in terms of film, just because of the way that us and Japan keep bouncing stuff like this back and forth with each other, and they make something, and we make something inspired by that, and they make something inspired by that, and years later, you have Top Gun, but it's giant robots, and everybody is flamboyantly gay.
I would say that we've reached a point where, like, a lot of what I love is being mined for money now. And that means that there's not going to be more of the stuff that I love being produced. And that's a sad moment for me and a sad realization for me. And if anybody needs clarity on exactly what I mean, there's not going to be any sitcoms like The Good Place being made anymore. There's not going to be multi-season long things like Parks and Recreation. There's not going to be, God help me, there's not going to be any more Will and Grace with, like, or any sitcoms on TV that are 24 episodes long. There's not going to be long form content anymore. There just isn't. We've left that era behind.
For now.
And now it's all like movies on Netflix, except it's 8 hours instead of 2 hours. God, I sound so old, but yeah, that's where I'm
I
at.
think there's pros and cons on that. And I personally dislike everything being so damn short, specifically because I think it's ruined a lot of recent mecha anime. But even over here, I feel like there's a lot of stuff that never gets time to breathe, and you never get a time to really sink into the character, like Brave New World, where it is like just the best fucking Star Trek thing made since the Next Generation when it was good. And it's a little bit stressful just getting so few episodes of it, so you don't have time to really get the characters fucking sunk in. And they're all so cool and interesting, and I want more of them. I want fucking Star Trek: The Next Generation, where I know things about some of these characters that, quite frankly, just shouldn't be known by anyone.
I was gonna say the shorter seasons have made it impossible to, like, it's not TV. Like, TV dis th that we that I grew up on has disappeared. It's not television at all, as I understand it.
Even when
It's
we were younger, there were still things like miniseries. It's still TV. It's just much more compact. It's all much more tightly written. And
Not though. That's what I'm trying to say.
most of
Like,
it,
the writing
the
is.
writing can still be bad, Oshi. I'm not saying that it's all good. I'm just saying that when, like, it's something. It's not written episode to episode during the filming of a long season anymore. And that helps with stuff like the budget, and that helps with stuff like keeping the writing tight, and it helps keep costs down, and helps make series a bit more expansive, even if they feel more limited in other ways. And I don't have to like it, but I do at least appreciate it for what it is. I'm not going to say it's not TV.
I'm not saying it's not TV. I'm drawing a line between an era of like television, the era of like content production before it was even called content production that existed, and an ecosystem that's disappeared. So the things that are foundational to what produced the stuff that I grew up on, that you grew up on, that we loved, doesn't exist anymore. It's so rapidly changed away from that than what will be produced. People were still figuring it out for the last 50, like 10. Yeah, I'd say about the last 10 years, they've been sort of figuring out how to use what they've been trying, like throwing everything at the thing.
Yeah, there was like a whole writer's strike over it, yeah.
Yeah, and now I think we're entering a new era, and I'm hoping that the signs in the anime industry are also reflected in maybe Western productions as well. And they start remembering that now you don't have to worry so much about. Maybe you do have to worry, but at least they understand what's coming, so they can set things up properly. They can create series that have more like fun to them, that have more entertainment value to them. The one that actually gives me hope for it is, you're not gonna love this. You're not a watcher of this. Shondaland produced Bridgerton. And I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. This is like seasonal anime level perfect. They produce like 8 episodes, they cover a book, it's internally consistent, it's fun, it's delightful, and you move on with your life. And there is no, and I, and it's completely resonant and satisfying to watch all the way through, which is not something that I typically get from like these short series. Okay, we've discussed enough TV, I think.
Yeah.
Have I gone too
No,
far?
you're fine. I was letting you like kind of get it out of your system so we can work up to talking about floss.
Well, there was a reason I was trying to create a bridge here.
Yeah. And oh my God, I know what the bridge is, and I was about to say something absolutely awful.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
Just okay, so if you know what the bridge is, go for
No,
it.
no, no. I would say so. On the subject of fucking isekai and an isekai's uncomfortable obsession with slavery, floss.
You fucking suck. No, that was not the bridge, ladies and gentlemen. It was Okay, so this change in format, this change, this whole divide. So the reason I'm talking a lot about this, and the way I connect it back to TWI, is that this episode is all about Chandrar and about Flos, and we're gonna be looking at what was the dividing line for Flos, and the sort of loss of his original kingdom, right?
Yeah, just sort of who he is as a character, who Trey are, who the supporting cast are. This is very much the this could effectively be considered the start of that story, in the same way that the first volume is the start of Eren's story, where it introduces all of the players and all of the fucking mechanics and themes of her stuff. And it.
Always at the pace that pirate sets, of course, not at the pace that a regular writer sets.
And in a less glib way of putting it, this is also where I think some of the deeper, more persistent social issues get dug into. Because, yeah, no, Floss has the single big flaw among all others here. And yeah, it's exactly fucking that. And I remember wanting to almost vomit when I got to that part reading the book.
Right.
'Cause
So the overview notes here say from a wonderful producer that the first chapters of Volume 4, which is The Last Light, the book The Last Light, focuses on Flos and the Kingdom of Rain. We get a lot of flashbacks to what happened when Flos was very powerful and he had the Seven to back him up. We get to see that we find out that the Empire of Sands sends back one of Flos's seven, Drevish, who was his architect, who built his cities and his fortresses and all things, back to the head of literal head of that person back to him. And it's just like all this horrible like back and forth. For me, it was a lot of horrible back and forth. We do find out like a lot about at least the region around Flos, right?
yeah.
It is like as he rises up immediately, a lot of people declare war on him. They're afraid of what he's gonna do. He almost gets crushed and all that stuff. We also find out I really didn't want to talk about the slavery bit right away, but if you want, do you want
Well,
to?
I think that at the very least we should remind people that it comes up, just in case anybody just wants to skip over this one.
We can
And
talk about it a little bit later then. I don't mind that.
yeah,
Is
a
that
little
okay?
bit later, because at some point I do also want to discuss why, for some reason, because this is common across this and a bunch of other isekai stories and the weirdly strange relationship they seem to have with portrayals of slavery. And this came out at such a time, it almost feels like it's subversive versus a lot of the fucking shield heroes of the world. And I kind of want to talk about that. The difference between Trey and Terrace, and the I live here, this is of the times, and this is wrong, I don't care if it's of the times mindset.
That's true. I think we get at least some personality from the twins. Now, not so much Terrace, but quite a bit of Trey, and it's based around their reaction to how Flos conducts war, right? How he brings his dead kingdom back, and how we get to see what the bond is between Ghazi and Flos, and what the bond and the developing bond between Trey and Ghazi, right? This is truly like an establishing set of chapters, and it really is all about just getting us to a place where like we understand why Flos is the way he is. We get to understand that he's not a nice guy. He is somebody who practices and practically uses the same kind of language of Earth's past, where people justify slavery because it's always been there, and that it just that's just the way the world works. I'm part of it, and I can't change things.
And everyone's doing it.
Yeah, everyone's doing it. Am I supposed to? Because everything is ultimately in service to his principles and his needs and his wants. And ultimately, that's war. The people who pledge themselves to that ever conquest feeling, like conquering the world, the Seven, and like, that's it. That's all that matters.
Yeah, he needs the money, and this is what's done. For all that Floss presents himself as this all-consuming conqueror, the pinnacle, the ideal of what it is to be the king, in a capital K, exclamation point sense, the authority, he ultimately too is revealed to be just as much another part of the system as everyone else. Even when one of his own Seven, who is a former slave that he rescued from slavery, tries to tell him otherwise, and just doesn't. And it is such a, like, For the most part about Floss, he's got that whole thing where his vices are his virtues, where, and we'll see this as time goes on, he is just too much of him fucking self. But I think that that would make him, you know, just another guy. But the, and this is just, I know this is so weird when there's so many other people in the setting who are also in this same boat and same mindset who I don't find this is so surprising from. I'm just surprised that this guy would participate in that system. It just, it feels so weird until he does it, and then you're like, oh, my read of him was entirely wrong. He's way worse than I thought he was.
He tells you from the start that he plans to take, like, somebody who says the words, I'm gonna take over the world, and it, conquest is his whole thing, and everybody was afraid of him. Sometimes they were afraid, and they did these terrible things to stop him for a good fucking reason. Right?
Yeah.
Not every, like, king who rises up is a good guy. I mean, I love Chandra. Like, there's a tale of Alexander the Great and how he, like, built the Greek Empire. Everyone's really proud of him. He was also a complete asshole, a narcissist, and a fuckwad at times.
So, Floss is, like, a living deconstruction of a lot of that narrative around the idea of these, you know, great men of history, who people forget, a lot of them were really just bog-standard Bronze Age conquerors who made it big and made it good. I mean, yeah, sure, I will give Alexander the Great credit as being also, like, good at a lot of other things, and maybe he almost lived up to that hype if he didn't fuck off and die in a stupid war for the sake of his own ego. But the man had a solid understanding of philosophy and writing, and even then, he was still a Bronze Age fucking conqueror. And Floss is cast in that same vein, but it almost feels like a sleight of hand, because throughout the course of these chapters, you can kind of tell why people are loyal to him, why people like him, why it feels like it's a little bit unfair that everyone is trying to crush him the moment that he comes out of his stupor and looks at the world. And then you realize that ultimately he's just more of the same, but arguably more successful. And until we get to meet more of the Empire of Sands that sent over Drevish's head, I'll say that, yeah, he's absolutely not the better option, but fuck those people, so he's the better option.
Yeah, so there's a bunch, like, Kylera helpfully put in a lot of Papa's notes from the various K chapters in this book, but here's the thing, though, there's only one note that I want to, there's two notes that I want to pull out. One is from, like, 4.03K, and at the end of that note, Papa says, I'm definitely no Floss, but I can understand a king who would try and compete against a god when he hears about stories like Jericho. That's what makes him fun to write, and I'm glad I remember that. And I think that's the attitude that you need to, like, center whenever you think about Floss. He doesn't see... His ego is so big it has its own solar system. He genuinely cannot conceive of a world where he can't, like, challenge anything and anyone in any way that he chooses, like, if he chooses to, within his bailiwick, right?
Yeah, but it makes sense when, in fact, you hear about his life story, and his life story is literally, yeah, I was, like, fucking 16 years old, and the moment I was fucking crowned, the enemy king tried to conquer us because he figured I was weak, and after I won that war, a bunch of other people got mad, so I got into a couple more wars, and then people just kept attacking me, and I kept not losing, and then I kept getting territory, and why can't I take on anyone or anything? I did so far. I conquered a whole continent. Quite frankly, the only reason I didn't conquer most of the world is because I got fucking bored of it and a little bit sad and decided it wasn't worth it anymore. Now I'm back in the fucking saddle.
Well, that's what he tells people.
I know. So what he tells people and what actually happened, I better put this. He went to sleep and he didn't tell anybody fucking anything, but and this is something we'll find out more of later when we get to Nears and what happened there with the fucking battle against the Gambler of Fate. I think that Floss himself does not understand himself and why he just fucking... He should have stopped at Chandrar.
So, I'll mention, before we get to the slave bit, I think we should, like, wrap it up around the slave bit. I'll mention straight up that there's a couple of secrets that get dropped here that's kind of significant for the overall story. And the biggest one, I think, from a character perspective, we find out Ghazi was a former slave. And we get to understand a little bit more about what it is that drove Ghazi to serve Floss, other than the obvious. Because Floss is the reason she no longer has the slave class. Now, the significance of this is something that will come into focus later in the series, but the fact that there is a class within the system called slave, and that it is impossible to lose, remove, or restrict unless a very powerful, like, high authority class, like king, removes it, is an indication of just how sticky slavery is. Like, we know, we as human beings in this world, it living, just let's talk about from a, because I'm from a U.S. and the U.S. I know, I was not raised in the Deep South. I did not have to, like, read books that made it sound like it was the war of Northern aggression or whatnot. I learned Black History Month from Black people. I learned about just how deep and fucked up and, like, horrible slavery was and what it left as a scar on an entire group of people and what it can do to dehumanize someone so that they are effectively chattel. Now, reinforce all of that with a class system, with magic, and then remove and then put it in the context of being before people got convinced that, hey, maybe doing these horrible things to other human beings and considering them another human being as less than you because, I don't know, you bought them might be bad. Like, as long as there's been slavery, there's always been people who've objected to it. But the fact that it took so long to... Anyway.
Yeah.
These kind of things just... The horror of it sank into me so hard. And watching Floss be part of that system was both not a surprise at all to me, but also, like, it's just more evidence that continues to make me think that he's not gonna surprise me ever. He's just very, very boring as a character.
You see, that it's amazing you consider that evidence that he's not gonna surprise you, because it did surprise me.
It didn't surprise me at all. Like, that I could see it come, like, as if he's a king, if he's a warlord, this is how you would act, and this is what he did. If he didn't do it, I would have been very surprised.
Yeah, this is, I got the feeling that he wasn't going to, and that that was being set up as a thing, as just like a writing decision. And then he did, and I realized that it made it much more interesting and deep as and flawed as a character, and that immediately made me more interested in him and Trey, because we know from like this and more stuff as time goes on that this guy is just fucking magnetic. He has that personality, and it is genuinely difficult for people to argue with him because he's also a petulant child about it and won't let it fucking go. So when fucking Trey just looks at him and says no and refuses to back down on it and leaves the fucking room, that made Trey immediately a lot more interesting to me.
I mean, it did give him character. I'll grant you that. I wish that the character came from the person of Trey rather than from an outside event. But I guess it makes sense. You know, when you test someone's mettle, you have to find out where their lines are, and that's how you define a character. And really, Trey and Terrace are defined by the fact that they're young and ill-defined because they never had to make those kind of choices
Yeah,
before.
they're just fucking young kids from, I think it was London, somewhere in the UK, right?
And somewhere in the UK. It was never really explained, and I don't think Pirate read a map and
But
decided where they are
they're
or something.
fucking kids, and they're not even like kids in the same way that, say, Aaron or Ryoka are also young, because Aaron and Ryoka are way more defined people because they've had passions in Aaron's case around chess, and hardships in Ryoka's case around her fucking family and struggles with mental illness. They're just folks, and they are in a lot of ways blank slates. They're clay tablets. Trey and Terrace are the most traditional isekai protagonist characters in this story, and we see them going through the most traditional isekai character arcs, and with, you know, the wandering and twist thrown in, but they're going in opposite directions. Terrace is becoming the person who is a part of the world and system, and Trey is becoming absolutely not that. And I think that if there's a flaw in this, it takes a little, just a too long into the next few King chapters for that to really make sense. Although this one did pick the right moment to end and hit with a fucking shock, that's for certain.
I had a thought while you were talking. The short of that thought was like something about Trey and Terrace. It was, oh God, I lost track of it because I was also trying to pay attention to you. I should have written it down. Do we know anything about something about not knowing about Trey and Terrace in conjunction with like something? I can't fucking remember
So
that sometimes.
I remember the most significant, I do remember probably the most significant thing we've learned about them is backstory and like before they came over, which I'm not going to
Well,
consider a
not
huge spoiler,
backstory.
but I'll put a quick spoiler warning on, is that they apparently did come from a relatively rough neighborhood, and Terrace is used to sort of being the person who looks after Trey.
Well, that's the thing about Trey and Terrace. That's what I was trying to get at. Oh, that's what it was. So we do know a little bit about like the class of people that got pulled off of Earth. And here's a it's not even a spoiler. It's just these are people with something significant about them, some kind of significant
Like
thing that.
Olympians, chess prodigies, like
Right,
in
exactly.
Ryoka.
So who the fuck are these kids?
That's the interesting thing, because we know that there's the people that get pulled over, and sometimes there's the people standing next to them. So
I don't know about that. I don't agree. I think everyone qualified. It's just that they qualified in different ways. The way I think Trey and Terrace did qualify, I just don't, they were the ones. The idea was always to pull the people with the most potential, right? I think that was what the whole spell thing was for the rear, and whatever that potential was, I think it's ill-defined at this point what it is, whatever criteria it is. But it's kind of easy to guess. It had to be somebody who could become those heroes in the clown like the clown chapter talked about. So what is it about Trey and Terrace that makes them have that potential?
I do think they specifically were meant to be pulled over, but I'm also going to disagree that everybody who gets pulled over is that person who was being aimed for. There's too many instances of groups being pulled over, and I think that it says something about... I think there is definitely a theme in here about the people who are probably not the ones meant to be pulled over being just as capable of rising to the occasion. But I also think there's a lot of fucking Gregs over here. And, you know, just fuck that guy. Real talk, though, I think that Trey and Terrace, whatever it is that was about them, I don't think it was really formed. I think it was, in a sense, different from a lot of the other people that have been pulled over, really just a question of raw potential. Also, there's some stuff about this ritual that's hugely spoilerific that makes me wonder if the way it was brute forced hasn't just led to... It pulled over the people it was supposed to, and now it's just fucking snatching people, right? Like, fucking weaves left and right. It's got them all in its hands.
Maybe. But we've come to the end of our time discussing this, and we don't want to go too deep into spoilers. So this was our The Last Lights Chandrar episode for us. Join us next time when we talk more about... The Last Light, I guess. It'll be other episodes, yeah. Right?
And oh god, I can't remember if... Because this is a re-recording, and I can't remember if I talked about my whole parole thing causing escalations in both wars or not in this one or the other one. I'll find another time to talk about it.
Yeah, we'll talk about it another time. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll see you next time. You've been listening to No Killing Goblins,
edited by Liquid Ender.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin, or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.